A minister on various occasions is supposed to inspire people to increase their devotional fervor, to comfort them, to scold them, and to inform them. And we are this morning in the informing mode. The sermon this morning is strange and unusual, but it will try to make an extremely important point for anyone who wants to be a serious student of Jewish and Christian scripture. And the point is that the Bible did not arise in a vacuum. It came out of a specific context. It fed on a past. It was influenced by the world around it. I realize that this comes as no great surprise to most of you, but I can assure you that it's not a widely held view among church people in general. The more typical view is the one some of us learned as children, that the Bible owes little or nothing to human authors, that God dictated it exactly as he wished it to be recorded, and that the ideas and the language are therefore strictly his. To discover that this theory simply will not work as a description of the Bible is one of the first steps toward a better understanding of Scripture. In a phrase that I think it would help all of us to remember, the Bible turns out to be culturally conditioned. And that being so, we have to determine when we read it which parts are temporary and local in their value and message, and which parts are lasting and universal. Whether a comment in Scripture, and there is one like this, that a certain giant had six toes on each foot and six fingers on each hand, is inspired in the same way that that comment is which says, God is love. It is our failure to make that distinction that causes most of the quarrels about interpretation and the eternal formation here and around the world of new and competing denominations. So the point is worth making. The Bible did not arise in a vacuum. It grew like a plant out of its own soil and climate, and we can misread it grievously if we read it out of context. What I would like to do now is take a simple, specific illustration to make my point. Not the most dramatic one we could find, but one that appeals to me and that I hope will hold your interest. It will show how the Bible reflects culture instead of creating it. I hope you recognize the scripture Donna read to you a few moments ago. It's part of the famous judgment scene in Matthew, where in the imagery of the Near East, a king will come, separate the world into two camps, and tell the sheep on the right hand that they are welcome, but that the goats on the left hand are to get lost. Now you ask yourself first, if you are a good and curious reader, why use goats to represent evil and sheep to be the symbols of goodness? I noticed several flocks of goats on a trip to Hutchinson last week, all grazing peacefully, and then some flocks of sheep. And from where I sat, they all seemed equally innocuous. But that must not have been true in the past for people who worked with them close up. Goats are not as cuddly looking as a woolly sheep, and more of them must have had a very bad disposition, because through the centuries they have had a terrible press. Evil-tempered, so we say, mean as an old goat. Lascivious, so we say disparagingly, look at that old goat. Nobody ever says, look at that old sheep. So our language and the language of the Bible reflect a pastoral world where centuries of experience created certain stereotypes about these two animals and made them useful as symbols. 20 centuries later, in our urban life, much of the flavor and punch of that ancient symbolism is lost. But I am not really interested in goats and sheep this morning. I'm interested in the other half of that reading, the one that deals with the symbolism of right and left. Why are the good people on the right and the bad people on the left? And I don't want to hear any political commentaries from you, because this happened a long time before that division. Is there some divine and cosmic prejudice in favor of the right? Or does the language simply reflect how people had already felt for a long time? The writer obviously takes it for granted that right stands for good and left for bad. He assumes it will not be necessary to explain it, which means that the idea had already penetrated deeply into thought and language long before he wrote. I looked last week at 25 different verses in the book of the Psalms alone, which take for granted, every one of them, the superiority of the right. They go something like this: the Lord is my right hand. The Lord holds me by his right hand. The Lord saves me with his right hand. The idea of right, standing for the skillful or the good, and the left for the awkward or the bad, is deeply imprinted in both Jewish and Christian scripture. When Stephen, in the New Testament, was stoned by a mob for his preaching, he told his attackers that he could see Jesus standing by the throne of God at God's right hand. But why not the left? Is the prejudice in favor of the right against the left justifiable because the Bible seems to endorse it? Or has the Bible itself simply picked up on a prejudice already ingrained in society and used it? And if your mind is running ahead of my speaking, as is likely to be the case in this audience, then you are asking another question. This one: if the Bible made uncritical use of ancient folklore about right and left, did it do that with any other ideas? Male chauvinism, for example, so that we can blame that on the culture and not on God. And then if your mind goes a little further afield, you can ask, if we rewrite the Bible to take out all the male chauvinism which has been seriously proposed, shouldn't we, in all fairness to that 10% of the population which is left-handed, rewrite the Bible to take out all the bias in favor of those who are right-handed? If that's where logic has tempted you to be at this moment, please come back to our main road and help me make the only point I have time to make this morning, that the Bible is a culturally conditioned book, and that to read it sensibly, we have to make allowances for what was temporary and local, useful once, but not anymore. In this particular matter of right being better than left, the authors of the Bible yielded to a pressure that was already ancient when they put pens to parchment. With about 90% of the world right-handed, it was natural to associate strength and skill with that hand and weakness and clumsiness with the other hand. In the beginning, the word right would suggest the purely physical: strength, skill, cunning, power. But by and by, there would be an extension of meaning. Since strength and skill are good things, then the word right would slowly take on the connotation of goodness. And since left was more often than not physically clumsy and awkward, then the word left would begin to suggest what is bad, inferior, evil. And that is exactly what happened. Carl Sagan, in a book of his called Dragons of Eden, puts it this way: almost without exception, all human languages, all of them, have built into them a polarity, a veer to the right. Right is associated with legality, correct behavior, high moral principles, firmness, and masculinity. Left is associated with weakness, cowardice, diffuseness of purpose, evil, and femininity. You could have guessed. If that final sexist note annoys some of you, as it should, it may be comforting to learn that for some unknown reason, almost twice as many men as women are left-handed. A few more people are equally at home in both directions. I have a son who is truly ambidextrous. He eats, writes, and draws with his right hand, but throws a baseball and kicks a football from the left side. He shoots a basketball layup with either hand equally well. Ambidextrous. But the odd thing about that word is that the old prejudice is affirmed even in the use of that word, because it literally means having two right hands. Now, all this linguistic bias in favor of the right goes far back. From the Greeks, we get the word orthodox. That's a good word. From orthos, meaning right, that is correct, plus doxia, teaching. The Latin word for right is dexter. And so dexterity in English means skillfulness. It is a compliment to be called dexterous. The French phrase for to the right is à droite, and we fuse it drop the final E and have an English word, adroit, which means clever, capable. All kinds of idiomatic expressions in our language capture this prejudice. We speak of the rights of man. Our most valued assistant is our right-hand man. We speak of a person being in her right mind. But if the right hand, by radiation of meaning, gives its name to skill and proper thought, the left gives its name to clumsiness and deceit. Our English word sinister is almost exactly the Latin word for left. Our word gauche, meaning awkward, is precisely the French word for left. In a left-handed marriage, the groom gave his left rather than his right hand to the bride to signify that the marriage was to an inferior who did not win for herself or her children the rights that would normally come to her. Such a wife and her children were called left-handed. Irish Protestants call a Catholic a left-footer, meaning deceitful and untrustworthy. We agree with someone by saying, "You're right." Otherwise, we say, "You're out in left field." In Ecclesiastes 10, verse 2, the verse that I've always thought Senator Jesse Helms would love to have on his stationery, we have this comment: "The thoughts of a wise man tend to the right, but the thoughts of a fool to the left." As the use of right in this particular way became ever more fixed in the popular mind, left-handers began to be looked at with some suspicion. By medieval times, a left-hander ran a serious risk of being accused of practicing witchcraft. The devil himself was thought to be a southpaw, and it was believed that he and other evil spirits could be conjured up by left-handed gestures. The Bible doesn't say it, but the rabbis decided that Eve was created from a rib on Adam's left side. John Milton knew that tradition, so he has Adam rebuke Eve in Paradise Lost by reminding her on two different occasions that she was taken out of his left side. Therefore, her defection was not a surprise to him. And since Milton was a superb Latinist, he called that the part sinister, that is, the left part of the body, a rib which Adam says was crooked by nature. And ever since, Christian language and ritual has kept much of this nonsense alive. The sign of the cross is made with the right hand, and the last movement is from left to right. It was felt that to do the benedictory blessing with the left hand was a form of blasphemy, and so it became part of the black mass, in which everything is turned upside down. Sometimes in a confirmation ceremony with lots of kids, the bishop might use both hands, reaching out to put one hand on one child's head, the other hand on another's head to hurry things up. But an old superstition held that the child confirmed with the left hand would always be unlucky. Like male chauvinism, this bias is built so deeply into language that we may never be able to get it out, but as you would suppose, some are trying. Left-Handers International has a branch up in Topeka that reminds us constantly that this prejudice bothers them. right-of-way, they point out, is good. Leftovers aren't. When you correct a mistake, you never left it. You right it. We extend to new members in the church the right hand of fellowship, even if the greeter is left-handed. The people in Topeka have drawn up a bill of lefts to remedy this old, old bias. And they may even have had something to do with creating a t-shirt I saw one day in Aspen with a slogan printed on it, which I now gladly dedicate to everyone in this room who is left-handed and has had to be patient with prejudice. You need to listen to this one carefully. Now, where is it? Oh, it's a wonderful quote. And I don't have it. Can I remember it? If it's true that the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body, and the right side of the brain controls the left side of the body, then left-handed people are the only ones in the world who are in their right mind. I don't know where that quote got left, but it didn't come with me this morning. I'm glad I made it through. And I am to suppose, I presume, that you applauded because you were fearful I would not make it, and you were relieved. Okay. Now, just in case you were not tuned in at the beginning, let me say once more why it makes sense to preach a peculiar sermon like this. It is one illustration out of dozens that I could use to show that the Bible is not to be read as a timeless document, every word of which is as relevant and useful for the 20th century as it was for the first. This one principle of interpretation would have saved us from at least half of all the nonsense which has plagued and pestered Christendom for 2,000 years. And I consider that reason enough to talk about sheep and goats, right and left, and to do something like this again next week under a title which is announced in your bulletin. I hope you'll be here again to worship and to think, to give to the words and ideas of sacred scripture the kind of serious attention they deserve. And I cannot resist pointing out to you that as you look up here each Sunday morning, the speaker is on your right. Please be with us next week.